I was wondering for your time with Longpo Cha.
Yeah.
The impressions we get about Longpo Cha from reading his teachings, but obviously none of us was around with him.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested in your experience of his personality, his character. What was most inspiring about how he conducted himself, how he spoke, how he behaved, that made him so inspiring to so many people?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question because, you know, he was, you know, a different person to different people. And he could be quite, you know, some people really praised his, you know, I'm so inspired by him because he's so fierce. And other people say, oh, I'm so inspired by him because he's got so much loving kindness. Or I've got so inspired by him because he's so simple. And so inspired by him because of his, you know, his wisdom to analyze things really. And so that, you know, to me, he was all of that. And I think he was comfortable in responding to the needs of others. I mean, if one tried to make a description of, or like a CV for what a bodhisattva should be, Lumpa Cha really would fill that bill. Because he could be, you know, he could be incredibly patient, and he could be, you know, he could be really quick to say something and admonish. Other times he could be really, but I think one of the things that, you know, maybe in terms of an underlying thread that I think we all felt was that he always had your best interests at heart, even when he criticized you or made fun of you, which it was hard to take that personally. It was really, you know, he was trying to, you know, one always felt that he was trying to help you in some way. And, you know, so, you know, inevitably there's sometimes, you know, it really hits the nail on the head, and other times it's, you know, a bit of a miss. But I don't think anybody ever felt that he was, you know, had any self-interest. And I think that's maybe a real strong characteristic for me, was that, you know, as an example, he was an example of somebody who completely lacking in self-interest, self-aggrandizement, self-promotion, self-cherishing. And so he, you know, when you think of anatta as a philosophical concept, that's one thing. But when you see somebody living a life of not self, then it's extremely beautiful and inspiring. Another aspect was a sense of just him being unshakable, completely not flustered by anything. And that was maybe about 2 years ago now. I was talking to my mother, and my mother said, you know, I'm cleaning out my stuff. I want to get rid of everything. And I've got all the letters you wrote from when you were traveling and when you were in Thailand. Do you want them? And I said, I've got a whole box of them. And I said, oh, I had no idea that she was saved everything. I guess that's what mothers do, I guess. So I said yes, and because there is a group of people working on a biography for me, and I thought, oh, there'll probably be some interesting material for people, for somebody else other than me to read. And I got this box of letters, and in one of them was a letter that I was I had sent, which I didn't realize. I had sent a whole, like, three boxes of slides, of like photographic slides, for my family, for them to see life at Wat Nana Chat in, I think it was January of 1976. It was a slice of life in January 1976. And then in the letter I wrote, I got a commentary of who the monks were, what they were. But then also part of the letter, because that was into my third year as a monk, and I said, you know, I haven't told you yet, but Ajahn Chah has a 5-year plan in that you know, he wants people to train with him for at least 5 years, and I'm committed to being here for that time because I see the benefit. And I said, and one of the main reasons why I feel comfortable to make that kind of commitment is because I see him as somebody who is, I mean, he's both peaceful and a good example of a teacher and leader, but mainly he's just really unshakable. And if I was able to spend 5 years here and get to be a little bit unshakable like him, then that would be something that I would really aspire to. So that sense of unshakable is a quality that he, to me, he exuded, you know, along with all the, because he was never locked into a particular personality, you know, in the sense of he didn't have a persona to try to fulfill that was the definitive Ajahn Chah. I mean, he was very fluid in terms of, yeah, again, the sense of, yeah, he could be quite demanding, he could be quite patient, he could be quite hilarious and funny and enjoy the sense of the absurd. He loved that, and he loved, of course, as most Thais do, they love to play with language. He's making puns and plays on words, he couldn't remember Pahrang names, so then he always had his name for who they were. And then for many years, Ajahn Sumedho was Ajahn Sumedho, but for many years he was, his lay name is Robert. And he wasn't very good at containing his temperament in the early years. And so that Ajahn Chah called him Labert. Labert is a bomb. to explode. Ajahn Amaro's lay name was Jeremy. And so he made it immediately became sort of Denja Labi, which is, you know, novice axle grease. So everybody had a kind of a nickname. I didn't have one. It was fortunate. Yeah, I came a little bit later. Like, I didn't actually ordain at Wat Pa Pong. I ordained elsewhere, so I didn't have a. And I came using my Pali name. So that was a fairly easy transition.
Pahrang Pur Sumedho had a bit of a temper at the beginning.
He did.
Would Rongpo Cha as well?
That would be kind of unthinkable. Ajahn Chah would make comments. He said, "Oh, Sumedho, you're sort of like, oh, you're looking really peaceful right now, but your ears are red." he didn't. I mean, he could tease us quite. It was done so. You felt it was always done with our best interests at heart.
Did it was Ajahn Amaro?
Pardon?
What was the nickname of Ajahn Amaro? Oh,
Jalabi. Jalabi is me, and his lay name was Jeremy. But Jalabi is. Yes, axle grease, or grease, like not kitchen grease, but like for machinery grease.
There's actually a recording of Rinpo Cha saying that, kind of chuckling.
Oh.
He says it. He's reading the names of the monks in England.
Oh.
He says something like Prat Amaro, and then you can hear him say, Yerabina. And he starts kind of chuckling because he's asking the other monks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering, in your long monastic life, whether you have felt sometimes chunks of time, like periods, maybe years or months, that kind of call for a particular quality that right now needs to be developed over a certain time, or like maybe like a submissions within the monastic life.
Definitely periods of time in my practice where I've picked up themes of, okay, I really need to pay attention to a certain quality. I really need to pay attention to this quality of putting forth effort. Sort of weary. Like, and they're sort of, you know, if you reflect on it in terms of, say, like Dhamma practice or classifications of Dhamma, and you think of, oh, well, what's a particular parami? Because that's how I conceived of it, in the sense of, because there's the 10 baramis, different qualities, spiritual qualities that are conducive. And the word barami itself has that connotation of crossing over. So it's the qualities that give one the skill, oomph, spiritual oomph, crossing over from samsara to nibbana, from kilesa to some kind of purity, from confusion to some kind of peace. So that recognizing that there's some kind of quality I should really be paying attention to. So certainly effort is one I've worked on, and patience, definitely. Okay, I need to develop a bit more patience. Quality of faith. So how do I nurture this quality of faith and devotion, and just not ought to doubt and uncertainty all the time. So yes, certainly in my practice and in my training over time, that would be a theme that would come up, and you focus on it for a period of months or years sometimes. And it's more like a touchstone, as opposed to, okay, every meditation I've got to get this. Yeah, but it's more like, this would be really fruitful to work on this element of, say, of character and temperament. Because we do have, we're not trying to eliminate our personalities. Not self doesn't mean that you sort of eliminate any kind of vestiges of personality. But there is this elements of character and temperament that we do need to pay attention to, that would be more conducive to our spiritual practice. So making it conscious is actually a good skill. And then thinking of different ways of attending to it, or different practices, and so doing really putting forth effort. I mean, certainly for myself, one of the things that I really paid attention to for developing in terms of weary barami, it was just, I would, and it still is, I did it for so long. Because even as a young monk starting to, but particularly because I was quite young as an abbot, then making sure that I, after the meal, I kept walking jomgom till at least noon. And then before sort of having a bit of a break, having a rest. So that very much became a part of my kind of go-to option as a piece of my temperament. Or, doing sitter's practice. Doing sitter's practice I did that from the first vasa of Wat Nana Chan. That was the first time I tried it. And that was really very helpful. So I went back to that from time to time over the years, and did a period of 3 months or 6 months, a year, even when I was the abbot of Wat Nana Chan. So it was helpful to develop that kind of weary as a piece of temperament. We've got certain habits and go-to options in our character, and you're not trying, as I said, you're not trying to eliminate it, but you're trying to modulate it so that it's useful and beneficial for practice and training.
Ajahn is a teacher I would like to know, in your opinion, what is often the most neglected blind spot in individual monk, and also as a community, what would be the most important quality to develop for the benefit of the group?
Yeah, very good. You know, I think, you know, in terms of probably the most unrecognized quality that tortures us all as practitioners is idealism. We just because most of us come to this when we're young and we're inspired and you know, you get really idealistic of how you would like to be, how the community should be, how the teaching should be, how the teacher should be, and that kind of, and because it's, say, the ideal is beautiful and inspiring, then it tends not to be examined in terms of its drawback, in the same way that every single thing has, it's like one of the ways that the Buddha described his awakening, because there are different ways that the Buddha described his awakening. Of course, Four Noble Truths is the most common. You know, it wasn't until I understood these Four Noble Truths and their 12 aspects that I was able to declare that I was a fully awakened Buddha. But similarly, one of the ways that the Buddha describes his awakening is, it wasn't until I truly saw the benefit as the benefit, the drawback as the drawback, and the way out as the way out, that I could declare that I was fully awakened. So it's sort of the benefit of a particular thought or a particular perception or any kind of idea. There is a benefit. Yeah, again, ideals inspire us, give us encouragement, inspiration, but nothing is completely good in and of itself. And so then we can torture ourselves with our idealism of, I should be a better monk. Well, of course you should be. We should all be better people. But, you know, we'll torture ourselves and make ourselves suffer out of that idealism. And so that's oftentimes not examined really clearly, or, you know, the practice should go like this. When you practice according to this teaching that's right in the suttas, here it is, then it should bring about four jhanas and the true insights and complete liberation. And why isn't it doing it to me? You know, so there's all the package of idealism that we carry with us is oftentimes not examined as clearly as it should. And so it makes for difficulties and obstacles for ourselves and kind of slows us down. You know, which doesn't mean you say, okay, I'm just going to kick back and be a jaded, lazy kind of practitioner. It's not the way at all, but it is sort of being willing to investigate, and that's why it's so important to keep reminding oneself that the foundation of the Buddha's teachings is always cast in, that the elephant's footprint of the Four Noble Truths is so important to keep internalizing, being willing to investigate that suffering, that dissatisfaction, that discontent, that dis-ease that we all experience, but to look at it as a dhamma rather than a personal fault or flaw or a personal affront to the idealized version of how things should be. That I would say is often unexamined or not examined as completely as it should. And in terms of a quality for living together in community, you just have to be patient. And, you know, just you know, other human beings are, you know, they're all, you know, other than me, you know, everybody's irritating. You know, it's, you know, why are they like they the way they are? And, you know, so that so just being patient with oneself and patient with others, and being willing to step back and, you know, kind of see the absurd aspects of community life and human personality. You know, and especially when you've got a group of people like that come together in a monastery, you know, as strange and irritating as we can be, you know, everybody comes here with a real wholesome intention. They're looking for something good. They're looking for something peaceful. They're looking for something to make sense, you know, in a really unpleasant and confusing world. You know, for myself, probably in terms of a source of suffering for me that I used and used for a long time and probably still continue to use, is just a sense of kind of fear and anxiety. That's sort of like that's my go-to option, you know, for my relationship with the world around me and my relationship with people. Is to opt for being anxious and fearful. So that being willing to keep working with that and confronting that and being able to find things to help to support ways of getting past that. So learn and then just learning different skills of how to gain, you know, a bit more inner confidence and inner stability, or, you know, a sense of you know, and of course hearing Ajahn Chah emphasize over and over and over again that it's a not sure, and because the anxious and fearful mind is always wanting things, trying to find some certainty somewhere, and of course it isn't anywhere at all except in this present moment and in the quality of awareness that we have. But yeah, the personality doesn't sort of believe that for a long time. So being able to work with you know, different aspects of, you know, fear and anxiety and worry, that those were my inner obstacles and inner source of suffering and complication. How to take a simple situation and complicate it quickly. start worrying and getting anxious and fearful. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, really, one of the things that I found extremely helpful was just mindfulness of the body. Because, you know, we try to resolve things mentally, but it's like the Ajahn Chah's blunt kind of say, you know, be careful of believing your mind because it's a liar and a cheat. You know, and of course, you know, we're here to train our mind, to liberate our mind, but then, and of course, that's the possibility is obviously there, but then it's also our mind that keeps drifting into proliferation and obfuscation, you're making things really unclear. And so that I found coming back to mindfulness of the body and paying attention to where and how I felt anxiety or fear or uncertainty or worry, and just learning how to relax at that point and just really a deep kind of letting go and being present and realizing that this, yeah, the quality of knowing is really the refuge and being able to return to the knowing and realizing, returning to mindfulness, returning to awareness, returning to clear comprehension, these foundations. I mean, they're kind of, on a certain level, very simple and basic fundamentals to practice, but I found that that provided the momentum for deeper understanding and recognition of, one, how to see things clearly, but then also how to let go.
Okay. I was wondering how you usually respond to claims that religion, Buddhism specifically, is kind of escapist, not nihilist in general, but just taking some words from like the last 15 minutes, you said like a way out or a confusing world.
Yeah.
You know, there's this idea that you want to kind of escape all this samsara and sankara and go somewhere else.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, there's different kinds of escape, and like there's escape with wisdom and there's escape with delusion. So that you have to qualify, because the Buddha, in the Buddha's teachings, he says there are different ways of answering questions, and sometimes you give a categorical answer, sometimes you give a respond with an analysis of the question, sometimes you respond with a counter question. So that sometimes if you want to explain it a bit more or to draw people out, oh, what do you mean by that? Because it's obviously, okay, whoever says, it's an escapist sort of strategy as a religion and not really, not dealing with the real world. And so, well what is the real world? No, and then if you start sort of drawing people out into that, and you sort of realize, okay, well, are you content with living in a life of chasing after ephemeral promises of gratification, which keep you not only unsatisfied but also in debt usually? So you want to analyze it a bit and be able to provide a perspective where you see where you can explain a bit more clearly what's the Buddha's escape actually is. And the escape is always an internal clarity that, again, is that word unshakable is used by the Buddha. Akupa Jeta Vimutti, the unshakable deliverance of mind. It's one of the really beautiful descriptions of the goal. But it's also it's only achieved through real wisdom and clear understanding. And also that it comes with a sense of empathy and compassion. Lokā Mahābhūta, who's considered one of the great enlightened masters of the forest tradition, and quite well known for his fiery temperament and his not suffering fools. So he would be he could be quite blunt and fierce with people. But somebody once asked him, "What is the mind of an enlightened being like?" And Lungta Mahabhua's answer was really interesting. He said, "Only compassion." It was really quite a touching response. And because, here's somebody who is considered enlightened and who is, by personality, he's considered quite rough and forceful. But then, when sort of asked, what is the nature of the enlightened being, is this compassion is a predominant theme. One doesn't escape from samsara without being empathetic and sympathetic to the plight of beings who are stuck in samsara. And it's really worthy of compassion and helping in some way.
Just to kind of follow up, not exactly a follow up, but with that attitude, I think it could be easy to kind of slip into, like, you know, just kind of like an unhappiness with the world when you're looking to kind of get out of it. And I've heard that the Buddha Sangha, when the Buddha was living, was incredibly happy and, you know, joyful because they were all in. How
do
you balance?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really important sort of question, because the it depends how it's approached and held. So that that sense of that search for freedom from samsara, freedom from suffering, you know, is the importance of being able to understand this is. This is not personal. We of course make it very personal, which is why we suffer. this is not personal. This samsara is just doing what samsara does, and deluded beings are just doing what deluded beings do. And so that being able to, but also seeing, reflecting on the limitation of that, and I think probably this balance of the Brahma Viharas are an important counterpoint to the kind of this, say, the dry investigation of, okay, you've got to, because it's even when you think in terms of the, say, like the, you know, reflection on Asubha Gamatana, which is, okay, the contemplation of the unbeautiful, the not attractive, and the hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin, the different parts of the external body, the internal organs, and all the things that ooze around and out and whatnot. And so I think, oh, this is really disgusting. But the way that the Buddha describes it, like in the Satipatthana Sutta, how it's held, is the description is of a sack, you know, contemplating the body as if it's a sack, you know, with holes at both ends, and you know, it's already a bit vivid, but the sense of this is hill rice, this is paddy rice, this is brown rice, these are green beans, these are yellow beans, these are mung beans. So they sort of say, yeah, that's the feeling that one gets is one of being very neutral and unshaken again, this is just what it is. So viewing the body like that, but then expanding that out and say, one's viewing the world like that. We're viewing samsara like that. It's just this. There's a set of teachings that comes up over and over and over again through the suttas. And it has a variety of starting points. Sometimes it starts from suffering and wise reflection. Sometimes it starts from faith. Sometimes it starts from sila. There's different elements of beginning. But then through that, there's an arising of, say, of delight, of pamoja. And then with this sense of delight and pamoja, there's the arising of joy, of piti, and with joy as a basis, the arising of tranquility and sort of ease and relaxing, pasati, and then with pasati as the foundation, and there's the arising of sukha, you know, sort of happiness of both physical and mental happiness, and then with the experience of sukha as the foundation, as the arising of samadhi. And it's also interesting that in some of the suttas, the Buddha actually stops at that point and the happy mind is easily concentrated, which is sort of usually, certainly I went about it backwards, and I think that most everybody else goes about it backwards in the sense of, you know, when I get my samadhi together, then I'm going to be happy. You know, but the Buddha, who is a lot more wise than we are, he says, get your happiness together and samadhi arises. But then with samadhi as the cause and condition, there's the arising of knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. And so yatha bhuta jnanadasana, sort of this sense of, there's this knowledge and vision that this is the way things truly are. It's like this. And that's a theme that comes up in Ajahn Chah's teachings. It's like this. Kenny, it's only this much. It's just this much. It's like this. Or Lupa Samero, it's like this. it's really that knowledge and vision of seeing things as they truly are. And it's through that knowledge and vision of things as they truly are that there's a sense of stepping back, a sense of dispassion and disenchantment. So, but the foundation is one of well-being. It's not like we have this disenchantment and dispassion and relinquishment coming out of negatively convincing ourselves that something's absolutely wrong. It's like you pay attention to the sources of well-being and clarity, and the heart releases and it disentangles.
If I mention about quality of awareness, quality of our present moment, how can we get this power of awareness? And does it depend on our effort or depend on our karma or fit?
No, it depends on how much you're willing to let go of self. You know, because as long as that power of awareness is coming from self, selfing, I need to do this, I'm going to put forth the, I'm going to make it happen, or I need to fulfill this ideal, then it's just going to be a miserable experience of awareness. But it's the degree to which one is willing to relinquish the sense of I-making, mind-making, underlying tendency to concede, the ahankara, mamankara, the mananusaya, the underlying tendency to creating an identity. So that's your that's a willingness to let go.
Before you mentioned with the qualities, kind of focusing on certain qualities, certain periods, you mentioned faith. I wanted to kind of maybe ask about that, how kind of to work on faith.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one for, I think, most of us as Westerners who grow up in a different religion, a different culture, and indoctrination of years and years and years of education. But I think just making it an object of attention, not trying to convince yourself that I should have more faith. This is a nice idea. Again, it's a nice ideal, but I think it's helpful to go back and use teachings of the Buddha as just reviewing fundamental teachings. That's where I think like anthologies of the Buddha's teachings are really useful. Like Bhikkhu Bodhi's In the Buddha's Words is really an excellent book that gives you a kind of a picture of, and also the Life of the Buddha by Nyanamoli, which is an old standard, but you get a picture of the Buddha and the teachings in that sense. So to me, that's a great source of kind of faith and confidence is, to me, is probably a better word. And for myself, I mean, I've done some, certainly having a nice Buddha image, having a nice shrine is helpful in that it, because it's so easy to, the go-to option to me is not kind of faith and devotion. Just clean my kuti and get on the jungle path and get do you know, or sit meditation or something, just do something practical. But having a nice shrine and keeping it clean and looking after it, I found that really, really helpful. But choosing images that are quite inspiring. Like I was, years ago, I was given a particular image that was designed and executed by one of Thailand's top artists. And it's really beautiful. To me, it's very beautiful. And so I got two main images on my shrine. That is on the top, and another one below that is an image that on a certain level is not, it's very ordinary as an image, but it's one that done by a lay person here in Ubon, who then had Lumpa Liem and some of Lumpa Liem's hair from his head from head shaving and mixed into the image and asked him to do special blessings for it, so that you know, there is a sort of a personal connection with this image for me, or something inspiring. You know, and then also just reading biographies of different practitioners and recognizing so you start seeing threads of consistency in these different great practitioners and there's in whatever tradition it's in. Like I was just yesterday, I went out and paid respects to Lopa Liem and the thought crossed my mind. We went out in some place out in the countryside, really in the middle of nowhere, which he's done many of these, and built a monastery, and built a sala, built a kitchen, built some kutis, built some toilets, and built a well, built a water source for the. And I actually asked him, how many of these have you done? and he said, well, there's nobody's, there's no record of it. And he said, probably at least 20. One of the people who came to my mind was a Chinese, very renowned Chan master, Master Su Yun, who was, he died in 1950 something, at the age of 120. And he had refurbished and rebuilt so many monasteries in his lifetime. And so this is just the example of these different beings' lives and how they live their lives quite differently. Find that a support of faith. Different ways of doing it. You have to sort of see. In practice, you have to always sort of take a bit of a shotgun approach. Something might land.
One of my question is related to through body and speech, you can control unwholesome action through precepts. But whatever pops up in the mind, Buddha said it is a steel. So it is automatic. We can't control. So how the karma is formed in the mind, whether we should control that thing or else it should be let go. What do you suggest?
Well, one of the things is it's from the sutta that the Buddha gave on two kinds of thought. I can't remember what. Majima 19 or something like that. And what you frequently think and ponder on becomes the inclination of the mind. And so that's the karma, is the thinking and pondering on a particular thought. So it's just recognizing, that kind of thought is this is painful, this is agitating, this is not helping me be peaceful or happy or having any clarity. So the letting go is in that recognition of its limitation and its inherent unsatisfactory nature. So it's just seeing that, and then what you're doing is then building the inclination of mind to relinquish confusing or agitating or not useful patterns of thought. So then it's a slow process. You can, one of the, I mean, Lumpa Cha sort of say, you know, one of the benefits, the main benefits of precepts, so the actual, paying attention and restraint in actions of body and speech, is that it helps one to see more clearly the volition behind the thoughts, the volition within the mind that happens. And you can start changing that volitional impulse, and change happens.
I have the second question. The question is related to whatever you do, you should do with care and attention. Like if I do with care and attention, the task would be, the time would be more. If I rush, if I want to do the task would be not be so good. So how do we give care and attention in a quick manner?
Well, I mean, there's different ways of having care and attention. I mean, I remember Ajahn Amaro telling the story of this supporter of Amravati was complaining to Ajahn Amaro about the difficulty that he was having with his family because they were really upset and unsupportive of his practicing Dhamma, practicing Buddhism, practicing meditation, and they both, you know, displayed irritation and made fun of him as well. And so Ajahn Amaro sort of immediately sort of, well, how does that play itself out that there? He said, well, you know, because I really try to be as mindful and careful and attentive as possible. So I have this continuity of mindfulness in everything that I do. So, you know, really trying to notice when, you see him being at family breakfast and sort of lifting, you know, carefully pouring the milk on his carefully laid out cereal, and his family getting completely irritated in front. So he's trying to exercise care and attention, but it is really, it's not, you've got to pay attention to what kind of care and attention. There's right mindfulness and there's wrong mindfulness. And part of mindfulness is also sampajanya, which is clear comprehension. A recent translation, or at least I recently came across the translation for sampajanya, usually as clear comprehension, as situational awareness. So that there's the function of mindfulness as when, because the constituents of mindfulness, like in the Satipatthana Sutta, atapi sampajano satima vinaya lokeya bicca dominasa. So atapi is a putting forth of effort. So mindfulness is not a passive recipient of experience. There's a putting forth of effort, and in particular, a putting forth of an effort that is freeing the mind from its defilements. Atapi sampajano. So sampajanya, or clear comprehension, situational awareness, that's a part of mindfulness, satima, possessed of mindfulness. So that there, and then in here possessed, there's right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness. So like Ajahn Chah sort of saying, yeah, a good thief is really mindful. You know, cats are really mindful. But, you know, it's not right mindfulness. So that there's these different qualities that when we think of mindfulness, it's not just a focused care and attention on an object. And then the last one, vinaya lokeya bicca dominasa, the relinquishing or stepping back from the likes and dislikes of the mind. So not being caught by our preferences, not being caught by our moods. So that when we think of mindfulness and we think of mindfully having care and attention in what we do, you want to have a big expanded perspective on that and sort of see, okay, how's this work? How do I apply it? How do I live it? How do I develop it? And how does it work for me? Okay?
have the last question related to meditation. That, like, when I sit for meditation in the open area, like when the weather is cold, like in winter, my mind will automatically go to sleep. If I sit in a closed, like a room, it is active. But in the open area, it is like a sleepy. When I sit, I will continuously sleep instead of on the bed, but I am on the couch. So what do you suggest, like, how to deal with this kind of sleepiness in the open space where you meditate?
Interesting. Usually that's kind of almost the opposite of most people. We just have to recognize what our own particular tendencies are. And then with sleepiness and drowsiness, of course, one of the first things is to pay attention to posture. Like really, you want to put some energy into an alert, upright posture so that you're using the posture for an application of energy. And then also not trying to focus too tightly on like a single object. Because if you, oftentimes what happens is we focus in on a tiny object, whether just the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose or this the feel of the rising and falling of the abdomen. It's you need an expanded, because the mind tends to drowsiness and lack of energy, then one has to expand the object that one's paying attention to, because it's much more important to dispel the hindrances than it is to focusing on an object of meditation. You want to say, the function of your meditation object is to help you to overcome the five hindrances, as opposed to just trying. If I get my mind on that object, then it's somehow something magical is going to happen, which maybe, but I wouldn't want to guarantee it. You want to be using the posture, using the expanding the object of your attention, so that you're maybe moving awareness through the body so that the mind has something to do. Otherwise, it wants to go to sleep.
So I recently, I was unable to come from this. And instead of closing the eyes, I started doing meditation with open eyes. That is working.
That was the next thing I was going to say. Okay, you're on to that one. Very good. Yeah, no, sort of you have to experiment and see. And certainly keeping the eyes open is really important, because we're visual. We get a lot of energy through the visual field. So being able to do that, keeping the eyes open. But yeah, try the other things as well.
I was wondering before, when you started teaching and taking on the role of a leader of a community, did that affect the way in which you related to your own practice? Because you were suddenly being seen by others, having to be more careful about conduct, for example, and that maybe when you're just among the one of many, one can kind of get away with being perhaps more careless about how one behaves in certain ways, speech or restraint and things like that. But when one is at the center of attention, that was helpful at that level or not?
Yeah, good question. I mean, it's hard to sometimes retrospective views are not so reliable. But I'm thinking when I first became the abbot and teaching responsibility for, I think I was probably suffering so much from other things that I wasn't really paying attention to how people were viewing me. Because I was, or trying to be something. I was just trying to survive. Because I I certainly didn't seek the position of being the abbot of Wat Nanachat, and certainly didn't feel I was ready. And I was quite young, really. I was only, it was my ninth year. I'd finished my eighth Asa already. It's in my ninth year of being a monk. And then Ajahn Chah. If anybody else had asked me to do it, then I hard to muster up my kind of resolve to do it. But it was Ajahn Chah. So it was non-negotiable. So you just had to do it. So just trying to get over my own sort of worries or you know anxieties and fears around having to take responsibility, having to be a leader, and not really knowing how to do it. Because we were all really pretty young. So that sense of, you know, just being willing to, I think one of the things that you know, saved me was really probably that faith in Ajahn Chah, that okay, Ajahn, in the sense, okay, Ajahn Chah has asked me to do it, I have to do it. And something that Ajahn Chah always emphasized was, whatever you're doing, you have to learn from it. And so that is your practice, that's your training. So taking that up as a theme of, you know, what can I learn from this? How can I learn from this? How can I grow from this? So it's always a question. And doing it in Thailand, there's, you know, of course, you're kind of accepted already just because of the nature of, say, Thai Buddhist culture. So certainly accepted in the society around or in the position around. But then within our own community, then, you know, just, you know, of Westerners, then you know you're being judged. So it's there's a lot more source of suffering around that. But I think trying to be a good monk, really, sort of that's all. Like that. And of course, there was the example of Ajahn Chah and the teachings of Ajahn Chah. And the first year that I was the abbot, then I still was able to go to chat and talk and be with Ajahn Chah. And he was getting sicker, but I made the point of always checking in with him and also going down at Upataki and when he was, because he was recuperating from this operation and recovering from that. So spend time with him, help out Upataki. And so getting these perspectives from him on how to basically let go of my own sort of neurotic worries and fears and just go ahead and do it and learn from it, be willing to learn from that. I can't really think of, you know, trying to hold myself up to a particular ideal. I'm just sort of basically, how do I survive this? And that ended up, I think, as a practical strategy.